Today, mission managers at NASA announced how they plan to extricate the Mars rover called Spirit from a predicament. Last April, the rover drove into some soft soil and got stuck. As NPR's Jill Palko reports, even if the plan fails, the rover missions have already been successful beyond anybody's wildest dreams.
It's hard to blame mission scientist Jim Bell of Cornell University for sounding a bit celebratory when he greets callers.
Happy Sol 2082 of our 90-day mission.
Sol is what scientists call a Martian day, slightly longer than an Earth day. Actually, I spoke with him earlier in the week. Today is Sol 2084, nearly 6 Earth years on Mars for what was originally designed to be a 3-month mission. Bell is the scientist in charge of the panoramic cameras, or PanCams. They've been sending back remarkable pictures. Just take a look on our website, npr.org.
We never imagined, of course, that they would be doing this well, but for the PanCams, we passed our 250,000 image mark.
Did you so crazily over-design these that they just, you know, they were built for 90 days, but they could last a decade? Or have you been lucky? Or can you see any signs of wear?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. I mean, you really can't talk about over-designing for something that you've never built before. Sony can tell you exactly how long any of its TVs are going to last because they build millions of them. But with space vehicles, they're one-offs. They're one-shot deals.
Or in this case, two-shot deals, because there are two PanCams working on Mars, one on the rover Opportunity, the other on the rover Spirit. And it's Spirit that's gone and got itself into trouble. Last April, as it was driving south, it broke through a thin layer of crusty soil. What was underneath was extremely fine-grained soil, and Spirit's wheels quickly got stuck.
We haven't found a clear solution to how to get Spirit out of its predicament.
John Callis is the rover project manager. He says the situation is challenging. One wheel on the rover stopped working years ago, now another may be in trouble. And the rover's underbelly, what Callis calls the belly pan, is perilously close to some rocks. And perhaps worst of all, every time they've tried to move the rover, it's sunk a little deeper. Sinking much further would be disastrous.
Because if you put the belly pan of the rover on the ground, that's pretty much game over in terms of trying to get the rover out, because then you would be bearing the weight of the rover on the belly pan and not on the wheels where you need the traction.
So after months of working on the problem, on Monday, the team will send the rover instructions to try backing out the way it came in. Managers sound hopeful, but not optimistic. Cornell's Jim Bell says even if the rescue plan fails, there is still science that Spirit can do. In addition to taking pictures, its robotic arm still works. So Bell says it can do things like
analysis of these salty deposits that the rover's stuck in. I mean, it's a great place to get stuck if you had to be stuck somewhere.
On the other side of Mars, Opportunity is still rolling along. It's on a 12-mile trek across a sandy plain to a crater scientists want to explore. Bell says Opportunity is still making cool discoveries. Just the other day, it came across a large rock.
The hope is that this is a piece of Mars that comes from somewhere else. It was thrown out by a big impact crater and just happens to have landed in our path. And this is kind of a free way to sample more of Mars than we have been sampling where we are.
Possibly one more feather in the rover's already well-decorated cap. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Now we're going to learn about some of history's most famous names, though you've probably never heard of the people who actually bore those names. Author John Bemelman's Marciano is just out with the book Anonymous, The Forgotten People Behind Everyday Words. Eponymous means anything named after a person, like Ford Motor Company or Washington, D.C. To qualify for this book, words also had to be anonymous, not generally associated with real people. Think Rudolf Diesel, Candido Jacuzzi, or maybe most famously, the Earl of Sandwich. John Bemelman's Marciano calls him the patron saint of anonymous.
He was a government minister in England. And there is an old story that was written by a French traveler that said that he was such an inveterate gambler that he invented the sandwich on a particular gambling binge so he would never have to get up from the gaming tables for 24 hours straight.
There is just one problem with that story. The Earl's family insists their ancestor invented the sandwich because he was such a tireless worker he did not want to get up from his desk. true or apocryphal, the stories in An Anoponymous led author Marciano to many linguistic discoveries.
The word that actually started me on this path was the word silhouette. To me, struck me as a very funny word. And I went to the Oxford English Dictionary. I looked up its etymology. And when it said that it came from Étienne de Silhouette, a French finance minister in the 18th century, I really couldn't believe it. I thought it had to be, it was like a joke or a mistake or something. The story goes that the French had a horrendous budget deficit, and he raised taxes, and he turned people into basically shadows of themselves. But somehow that story then evolved that he actually practiced the art of shade cutting, which is where the word was first adopted. So within history, these things get very mixed up.
Well, it does seem that a fair number of these come from inventors, Fahrenheit and Celsius, yep, and voltage. And among those, what would be your favorite?
I love the story of Jules Lyotard. He actually was going to be a law student, and his father ran a gymnasium in the south of France. And he had the idea of taking the bars that gymnasts use and basically suspending them from a ceiling and then traveling from one to the other while they were moving and doing somersaults between them.
Swings, yeah.
Swings. And there was a promoter in Paris who caught wind of it and came down to the south of France, saw him doing it, and then booked him into the largest venue in Paris. And he became an absolute sensation. And one of his other inventions was he knew that he had a pretty good physique, so he wanted to show that off. So he invented the one-piece athletic outfit, and that became the leotard. And it became this sensation around Paris and was used in dance studios especially.
Another area is mythology.
Yeah.
And one of the characters out of mythology gave us the word tantalize.
Tantalize, yes. Tantalus was punished by the gods, and they came up with a very unique punishment for him, which was for all eternity, he had to stand in a river with fruit branches above him. And every time he tried to reach up to take a bite of fruit, wind lifted the branch out of his hands. And whenever he tried to bend down to take a drink of water, the level of water went too low for him to drink.
So forever doomed to be tantalized.
Yes.
Galvanize.
Galvani, Luigi Galvani. He was a scientist, and he was one of those guys who was, was a spectacular accident. He had two passions. One of them was electricity, and the other was animal biology. This is a couple of hundred years ago in Italy. And he had a laboratory, and he had this electricity machine, and it created sparks. And he had been dissecting a frog on the same table. And by mistake, one of his assistants touched the electricity machine to the frog's legs, and the frog's legs sprang to life. And he suddenly realized there must be electricity in animals. And it was, it was like that you stuck your chocolate in my peanut butter moment. And eventually led Volta, who was his friend and contemporary, to invent the first battery.
One that I think might surprise people is the Frisbee.
That was a really surprising one for me. There was a woman named Mary Frisbee who made pies in Connecticut. And Yale students, other colleges have claimed it, but most people think it was actually Yale students, would throw around her pie plates after they had finished her pies. And it said on them, Frisbee. And kind of like you would say incoming, they would say Frisbee. So, just to give people the heads up and know that there was something spinning and flying that was coming out their head. Now, what was interesting about this, there was a corporation called the Whammo Corporation that, of course, made the hula hoop. And they had a spinning disc that was called the Pluto Platter.
And I've seen where that's going.
Yes. And it wasn't doing that well. And they couldn't quite figure out why it wasn't doing well. And they went around to college campuses knowing that this is where trends started. And to their surprise, in the Northeast, people were already throwing flying discs, and they had this name Frisbee for it. Mm. So they said, well, that's a much better name than the Pluto Platter. So Mary Frisbee's name was actually spelled F-R-I-S-B-I-E. They changed it to be E-E so they could trademark it. And that's how Frisbee became Frisbee.
Now, you write that there are a lot of phony eponyms on the internet.
Yeah, those are my favorites.
Domenico da Cama.
Domenico da Cama. Originally, the Bible was unpunctuated, and supposedly Domenico da Camma, to make it more easily readable, inserted commas into the Bible, and he was killed by the Inquisition for they said that the punctuation was an affront to God. Sadly, though, it's not true. The comma actually comes from Greek, meaning to cut off.
But why do you think they're so wonderful? Partly because they're no more ludicrous than most of the real ones.
Well, no, I mean that's the amazing thing. I mean, like, why is Leopold von Asphalt, you know, which is completely fake, any more strange than Rudolf Diesel?
Could have been. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. This has been great.
John Bemelman's Marciano is the author of An Anaponymous, The Forgotten People Behind Everyday Words. And you can read why Philadelphia whiskey maker E.G. Booz did not make it into the book at our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Many of the late Roald Dahl's acclaimed books for young readers have been made into films, among them Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Matilda, and James and the Giant Peach. The latest book to reach the screen is The Fantastic Mr. Fox, the first animated film directed by Wes Anderson, who's best known for his features Rushmore and The Royal Tenenbaums. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Wes Anderson has a cult of worshippers, but I often find his films a little precious and mannered, a series of colorful dollhouses with people posed like puppets in the center of the frame. Now, in The Fantastic Mr. Fox, he's made an animated film in which the puppets are so vivid they seem like people. It's still the work of a filmmaker who likes to preen, a dandy, but it gels because the hero, the wily master thief Mr. Fox, is a dandy too. He even wears double-breasted suits inspired by Anderson's own showy wardrobe. And it gels because the animation fits the story. Anderson opted to use stop motion, the old-fashioned time-lapse animation that gave us King Kong and this year's sublime Coraline. So instead of the smooth, computerized feel of most modern animation, there's a slight jerkiness to the characters' movements that brings out their weight, their substance. I don't know how, but I felt as if the puppets themselves were taking pleasure in their own movements. Anderson's ultra-composed frames have never seemed so magically alive. The script by Anderson and Noah Baumbach embellishes Roald Dahl's brisk and cheerfully wicked kids' book, but the thrust is the same. Mr. Fox can't resist the challenge of stealing from his new neighbors, three nasty farmers named Bogus and Bunce and Bean, one fat, one short, one lean. He pulls off three splendid capers, but doesn't reckon on the vindictiveness of the farmers, especially the skeletal Bean. George Clooney does the voice of Mr. Fox, and at first I couldn't stop picturing his handsome mug. But Clooney is doing his best work in years. He even parodies his Ocean's 11 master thief. Like his director, Mr. Fox is wonderfully precise. As he assembles a team of animals to help him fight the farmers who've laid siege to his underground hideaway, he calls them by their English and Latin names.
All right, let's start planning. Who knows shorthand? Great. Linda, Lucha Lucha, you got some dry paper? Here we go. Mole, Talpa Europea, what do you got?
I can see in the dark.
That's incredible. We can use that, Linda.
Got it.
Rabbit, Oryctolagus Caniculus.
I'm fast.
You bet you are, Linda.
Got it.
Beaver, Castor Fiber.
I can chew through wood.
Amazing, Linda.
Got it.
Badger, Melis Melis.
Demolitions expert.
What?
Since when?
Explosions, flames, burning things.
Demolitions expert. Okay, Linda.
Got it.
Weasel.
Mastella Navala.
Stop yelling.
All right. Ha.
Woohoo.
All right, Ash, you get these little kids organized and put together some kind of KP unit or something to keep this sewer clean. It's good for morale.
Done. What's KP?
I think it means janitors.
After the Beach Boys on the soundtrack come Burl Ives, Mozart, the Rolling Stones, and Old Man River. Disjunctive, But then the whole movie's disjunctive, like the cultural bric-a-brac in Wes Anderson's Teeming Brain. You'll find your eyes roaming the frames and laughing at the flourishes and textures, at symmetry that's slightly unbalanced, so the screen is a seesaw. There are gags so ingenious they'd have made Bugs Bunny director Chuck Jones gasp. The actors bring their own kind of wit. Bill Murray as a militant badger, Michael Gambon as Creepy Bean, Wally Wolodarski as Mr. Fox's nervous opossum sidekick, and best of all, Willem Dafoe as a hepcat knife-wielding rat security guard. Meryl Streep is the sharp, practical Mrs. Fox, who at one point slaps her reckless husband's face. You don't see stuff that serious in many animated family films. The Fantastic Mr. Fox is weighted down by a serious motif, one that runs through all Anderson's work. The son who desperately tries to forge a bond with his unappreciative father. Mr. Fox's boy, Ash, Jason Schwartzman, doesn't have his dad's athletic prowess, and he's hurt when Mr. Fox sees a chip off the old block in his cousin. The problem is Ash is a bit of a drag, and his efforts to prove himself are the movie's lone concession to formula. A small price to pay. With all the engineering behind the Fantastic Mr. Fox, it still feels handmade, as if the artists were in the room, manipulating everything on screen. When it ended, I wish they'd come out and take a bow. Animation director Mark Gustafson, cinematographer Tristan Oliver, designer Nelson Lowry, the whole team, and of course, Wes Anderson, who for the first time has a right to preen.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
India is not the only place where skin lighteners are popular. In this country, former baseball all-star Sammy Sosa turned up at the Latin Grammy Awards last week looking, well, fairer than usual. That ignited speculation that Sosa, best known for his years with the Chicago Cubs, had bleached his skin or was suffering from some sort of medical condition.
The slugger spoke up yesterday in an interview with the Spanish-language network Univision. Mr. Sosa downplayed the apparent change in his skin color. He said he's been using a moisturizer to soften his skin, and he says that cream, combined with the bright television lights set up for the ceremony, made his skin look lighter than it is. The U.S. Education Department has more than $4 billion in stimulus money that it's prepared to hand out. The White House says the race to the top fund will set off a wave of innovation by rewarding the best ideas for improving student achievement. That's what the White House says. But before a dollar has been awarded, the fund is controversial. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Physics students know this. A good way to move a big, heavy object is with a lever. If the big object is the U.S. education system, the lever is money, as President Obama explained last week to an audience at a Wisconsin middle school.
If you're willing to hold yourselves more accountable, and if you develop a strong plan to improve the quality of education in your state, then we'll offer you a big grant to help you make that plan a reality.
So the administration is delighted that many states have already rushed to change laws just to make themselves eligible for race to the top money. But in fact, it's that rush to qualify that makes John Ashley of the Wisconsin Association of School Boards very uneasy.
We now see states scrambling to read the minds of the Department of Education as to what would make their state eligible for the funds.
For example, in Wisconsin, legislators threw out a ban on linking teacher evaluations to student achievement. The administration said that ban had to go so states could experiment with rewards for teachers whose students do well. But John Ashley says the new law doesn't really make it any easier to get rid of ineffective teachers.
It seems to be more geared toward helping us reward successful teachers, yet not allowing us to take the information to dismiss a teacher that's not performing effectively, which I think harms the teachers who are doing a great job.
But Education Secretary Arne Duncan says race to the top is meant to give states flexibility, not to tell them what to do.
Based upon their history of accomplishments and their capacity to deliver on a courageous plan that they themselves design.
That's in contrast to No Child Left Behind, a legacy of the last administration, which is seen by many local officials as federal meddling in state affairs. Duncan says race to the top will only reward sincere efforts to improve student achievement.
If anyone's just doing things to chase a few dollars, that's not the kind of transformational change we want, and it's frankly not the kind of places we're going to invest in.
But many states have invested big time in figuring out just what they need to do to compete for money that is badly needed given tight school budgets. The new rules for the competition run well over 100 pages. The Gates Foundation is handing out grants to help states negotiate the application process. Anthony Cody coaches science teachers for the Oakland Public Schools, but in his spare time, he's been railing against Race to the Top on his Facebook page.
People with large amounts of money are using that money to leverage change that they want.
Cody and other teachers are particularly worried that Race to the Top will accelerate the reliance on testing that began under No Child Left Behind and that it will punish teachers if scores don't improve.
President Obama campaigned on the notion that we would move away from punishing schools for low test scores, yet that practice continues.
Now, $4 billion is a lot of money, but it's not enough to reward every bright idea. There will be winners and losers, and most states will probably get nothing from the fund. But Secretary Arne Duncan says that's not the point.
If folks are doing this because it's the right thing for children, then whether or not they receive the money, children are going to benefit.
The Education Department says Race to the Top is an incentive program. It's not punitive, the way No Child Left Behind is perceived to be, but the department will have a lot of public relations work to do to make sure the fund is seen as a helpful lever and not as a big stick. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
CNN is redesigning its lineup, at least in the 7 o'clock Eastern hour. That opportunity arises after an unexpected announcement last night by anchor Lou Dobbs. Mr. Dobbs announced that he was leaving immediately. As NPR's David Folkenflik reports, the rupture may help CNN clarify its identity.
Just listen to what former CNN anchor Frank Sesno says about Dobbs' announcement.
I think this is an important moment and a moment of distinction. And if CNN is saying to the world, our voice is going to be a voice of information and a voice of credible information, that's very important.
Sesno is now director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. He remembers Dobbs's reputation as a friend of the business establishment, at least until early this decade. Dobbs became an economics populist and a hawkish foe of illegal immigration. Sesno says Dobbs and CNN officials had looked at the success of the highly opinionated Fox News hosts Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and thought, why not him?
Lou's had his ups and downs throughout his tenure at CNN. He's a very strong, forceful personality, and he has very strong, forceful views. And it may have taken some time, but apparently this was not a fit for Lou or for CNN.
And that's because CNN has promoted itself most recently as the last home for unbiased journalism on cable television. Fox News has drawn big ratings with hosts who are right of center and, in Glenn Beck's case, right of center, and MSNBC has had some success by veering to the left in primetime. CNN has, by comparison, struggled, and Dobbs' ratings haven't been great either, well under a million viewers each night. Yet, if CNN's mark of distinction has been its objectivity, well, you never would have known from watching Lou Dobbs Tonight or listening to his syndicated radio show. Here he was talking about President Obama.
I'm moving from being an independent, sir, to being absolutely opposed to any policy you could conceive of.
And this past summer, he repeatedly breathed life into the theories of the so-called birther movement over Mr. Obama's birthplace and his standing to be president.
A lot of questions remaining, and seemingly the questions won't go away because they haven't been dealt with.
That despite the reporting of CNN and others disproving any doubts. Dobbs has been strident about illegal immigration to the point where many advocates say he was bashing Latinos. Angelo Falcone is president of the National Institute for Latino Policy in New York.
This past year, we kind of intensified our efforts to raise this issue about Lou Dobbs, the appropriateness of Lou Dobbs being on CNN.
John Klein is president of CNN's American News Channel. He says Dobbs' critics have it all wrong.
Well, you know, we've been talking since the beginning of the year, Lou and I, about the overall positioning of the network and the need for him to remove opinion from his show. And to his credit, he understood that strategy, he respected it, and he embraced it.
But Klein says Dobbs didn't like the constraints and asked to leave. Klein says it was an amicable parting and one that should help both sides.
We are a very profitable company because of our commitment to journalism. So we don't want to do anything that is off mission, and we're not going to be.
Dobbs didn't return a message seeking comment. He'll still have the radio show and told viewers he'll keep advocating his views. Klein announced today that a replacement show will feature CNN political host John King, a quintessential reporter not known for expressing personal beliefs. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.